Okay, so thank you all for being here. It's great to see such a full full room of faces. As a brief introduction, I did my DRPH at Cal, so locally, and now I'm an assistant professor in the Global Health track of the Public Health Program at Toro University, which is on Mare Island, north of us, northeast. And today I'm going to be talking about part of the work that I did at Cal and I'm continuing at Toro, and it's primarily on vouchers, so these voucher programs, which I'm going to sort of walk through the way vouchers work and this particular evaluative, qualitative evaluation that we did in Cambodia on behalf of my fellow authors here. And I have no relationships to disclose. It's impossible to talk about any aspect of Cambodian society without acknowledging the implications of the genocide, which occurred in the 70s. Almost any health indicator you can look at, you'll see a similar sort of dip and rebound function. This particular line graph shows the fertility rates, and as we know from studies across the world, that after tragedies on this scale, wars, conflicts, we see rebound fertility. But at the same time as we saw this increase in fertility, we also had a devastated health system, along with all the other social services in the country. And so this resulted in one of the highest maternal mortality ratios in the region. And that's sort of our baseline for this talk. So post-genocide Cambodia, there was a focus on rebuilding and restructuring the health system and trying to build things back in a way that was going to be slow and sustainable. And at some point in the 90s, the health system really wasn't able to meet the needs of the population. And they decided to institute user fees in an effort to sort of inject the health system with new funds, also to sort of improve the quality of the health system. And we know from other places that user fees can have a detrimental effect on utilization of services, particularly the poorest. And so studies show from Cambodia that after 97, after the user fees, utilization rates went down, and actually the poorest had unmanageable healthcare debt. And so this clearly wasn't going to work in the long term. And so the government decided to look at different ways to organize social protection programs to extend the reach of services all the way to the poorest, so that those out-of-pocket expenses for user fees were no longer going to be a barrier to care. And the first biggest program that they instituted is called Health Equity Funds, which is a wonderful program that actually evaluations have shown that has reduced out-of-pocket expenses for the poor, but it's really only at the provincial hospital level. And so poor people can present at the hospital. They undergo sort of a poverty grading scheme prior to any need of health care. So there's a poverty assessment. They get a poor card, an ID poor card. They present at the hospital, and they get free services. And that has worked really well, but as one of these clinics here in the rural areas, these funds were not available in the provincial at the provincial level. And so the Cambodian government decided to push on further and investigate ways around the world that people were using innovative strategies to try to link provincial centers with social protection programs. And they came up with these voucher programs. And early pilots showed success in small areas, and they worked with the German government and other donors to scale up a larger program. And that's the program that we were looking at today. So this is an example of a voucher. Sometimes when I'm talking about vouchers, I sort of use the a common, something that most people know about, sort of a Groupon. So vouchers are sort of a Groupon or a coupon for healthcare in a lot of ways. So you receive this card, and it gives you, in this case, this is a family planning voucher. So this gives you access to counseling and then family planning services. There's also maternal health vouchers that are specifically for antenatal care and delivery and postpartum care. Actually, vouchers around the world have been used for all sorts of things, for insecticide-treated bed nets, you know, even primary care. So people are experimenting with these vouchers and seeing what they can do with them. The real sort of catch here, this is not revolutionary, but it's innovative because when you're given one of these vouchers, not only do you get information and counseling, but then you also get a transportation stipend and you have a reduced cost. So there's sort of several barriers to care that are reduced through this program, theoretically. And so we wanted to see if that was true, if that was happening. And so just to give you kind of a better understanding of how the voucher programs work, as I said, the Ministry of Health in any country, this is sort of broadly, will partner with a donor, and they'll hire a voucher management agency. And these agencies are responsible for two main things. One is to hire and train voucher distributors, and the other is to accredit facilities that are going to be included in the scheme. That means that every facility included in the scheme goes under a quality assessment, and if they pass that assessment, they can be included in the voucher program. The incentive for clinics to be part of this is that they get sort of reliable income once all the utilization, all the barriers to utilization are reduced, more people come in, they have clients who can't pay, but with their voucher, they get reimbursed. So they're incentivized to be part of the scheme and to maintain a high quality. Voucher distributors are usually paid for their work, and they, in the Cambodian case, go door to door and actually deliver these vouchers to women of reproductive age. So that's how the scheme works. You might need to give me a time check when I...
Yeah.
So our main research question was really looking at the perceptions and experiences of women around the factors that facilitate and inhibit their redemption of vouchers. And our, as I said at the beginning, mainly we use qualitative methods. We started with key informant interviews and site visits to kind of get a sense of what the program, where the program was. We came in at the very beginning, so the program had just months before been implemented, had been launched, and we were coming early on to try to gather some evaluative information so that we could hopefully inform the implementation process and kind of change things as needed, depending on what we found. And so our primary data collection method was focus groups. And these were done just like this in open air settings. Most of them were done either at a village chief's house or a community center, a place where everyone knew and it was easy to access. We selected the villages for focus groups randomly out of the three districts. So we randomly selected three villages from each district, and then we contacted the chief of that village and invited him to participate, and then he then invited subjects to come on a particular day and time to participate. So this was an opt-in strategy, which I'll talk about in our limitations, has issues, but in this case it was really our only option for being able to feasibly get women around a facilitator and discuss these issues. And so we collected all sorts of focus group data, 2 to 3 hours worth of conversation, 9 focus groups. We put them all into, NVivo. I don't know if anyone's used this program. Quite helpful for data management. Still doesn't, you know, do the analysis for you. You're still kind of digging through data in a lot of ways. And so So we used NVivo to come up with our initial broad codes. So there was 2 researchers who came up with the initial codes, and we got together and compared our codes. From there, after we open coded for these broad codes, we then used axial coding and we put together this framework. And so our study aim, again, is to get at experiences and perceptions. And we looked at both factors that facilitate and inhibit. And what came out of the discussion was that there was really 3 big buckets that most people's comments fell under. The first bucket was what happened before the voucher, so things like demand issues before the voucher came about, and then factors associated with the distribution, and finally things that might facilitate or inhibit redemption. I'm just going to go through a couple of quotes so you can see the richness of the data that we got. Facilitative factors, so pre-voucher, things that happened before the voucher came along and may not have been affected by the presence of a voucher at all, things like the demand for family planning. For the most part, women were interested in using contraceptives to space children or to limit them, and they had all sorts of reasons why. A lot of the time it was about earning money or having the time or being able to take care of all those children, those types of things. So the demand for a lot of these services was there. Distribution, household visits made it really easy, come right to the door. Women said that was absolutely necessary. If they had to go somewhere to get the voucher, wouldn't have happened. And then redemption. The primary reason that women liked this program is because they could see the cost reduction instantly. They had the voucher. That meant they could go to the facilities more often, more easily, because they also got a transportation stipend. So you have a bunch of cost reductions in that way. Sort of more interestingly, we have the inhibitive factors. In the pre-voucher conversations, things like the negative experiences with side effects or negative experiences with providers, those things existed before the voucher and really hadn't changed much because of the presence of the program. And so women still felt like, well, I have this voucher, I could use it, I'm probably not going to because I've had past experiences that were negative. I felt weak when I used the pill or different kinds of things. In terms of distribution, we picked up on some issues such as the misclassification of poverty. So some women saying, well, I'm poor, but I live in a household, my mother's household, for example, and her house looks nice. You know, the poverty grading scale was really an asset-based scale, so looking at the type of roof you have and the type of, if you have a bicycle, those types of things. And so this woman didn't receive a voucher even though she herself would have been eligible. And then finally, redemption issues. So things that happen at the facility. In this setting, a lot of the women talked about unofficial payments. Some of those were things like tea money, which was a gratitude payment to midwives after the birth, after assisting with the birth. This is money that's above and beyond their government salary, so women should be able to get free services in a public center. But you know, those salaries are quite low, and midwives need other ways to incentivize them to stay in these remote areas, and a lot of times they expect that from their community. Other things like food or linens, clothes, washing, things like that in the facility, oftentimes you have to pay for that yourself. And so those are sort of other payments that weren't captured in this voucher scheme. And so really what that left us with very briefly is that for a lot of, most of what we heard were really positive things about this program. It resulted in seeking earlier and more frequent care. We love that here in public health. And it women talked about this feeling of security and mental ease. One woman said, you know, it feels like I have a mother out there caring for me. You know, come to the hospital, we'll pay for you. But other things that were important for program considerations are things like, you know, getting a sense of existing perceptions about services can really inform the counselor, the distributor's counseling, and the other types of counseling surrounding this program. So if you're going to address the things that were existing before the voucher program, you need to include that within the voucher training, the distributor training. The poverty grading process could use some improvement, as we could see, more individual level grading perhaps. And then finally, we need to think about ways to manage the T-money transactions. Now, this is a big request, but things like incentivizing midwives so that they feel comfortable, you know, providing services in these settings, and they're able to stay there without having to elicit money from their clients. Just briefly, strengths and limitations. I felt like in a lot of ways our study design was the perfect way to answer this question, but there were a lot of challenges trying to find, for example, private confidential spaces. We were most of the time sitting in open spaces. There were a lot of times people walking by. Usually the village chief here, who was a huge asset when it came to putting this research together, could have also been sort of seen as a liability because he was at the very beginning when we first started, a lot of them would sort of come around and make comments and, come on, tell them about that time, you know, you did this and that. I'm like, oh, you're not facilitating this focus group. So we really had to think about trying to structure this in a way that was going to be inclusive of the whole community, but also give privacy and space for the people who were responding. And so our final word here, implications for this research, is that early information from the voices of program beneficiaries can help to lead to better program implementation and to make changes early on as needed. Thank you.